Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series.
Hi, my name is Leah Jing McIntosh. I'm the editor of Liminal Magazine, and welcome to Melbourne Writers Festival. I am speaking to you from the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri and Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to their elders, past and present. This land was stolen, never ceded. It always was and always will be Aboriginal land. Melbourne Writers Festival Digital brings the world's literary voices to you via video. Today, I'm here with Viet Tan Nguyen, a writer, professor, activist, and editor. He published his debut novel, The Sympathizer, in 2015. A literary spy novel of ideas, he took out a slew of literary awards, including the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. Viet has been awarded both the MacArthur Genius Grant and a Guggenheim Fellowship. He writes searing op-eds for the New York Times. And I could go on, but his curriculum vitae is quite literally 72 pages long. He is here today to talk about The Committed, his second novel published earlier this year. So, hey, Viet. How are you going?
It's good. How about you?
I'm good. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from my basement office in Pasadena, California, right next to Los Angeles.
Beautiful. I love this backdrop. Just to give some context to our audience, we actually spoke earlier this year for a very wide-ranging profile for the Saturday paper. So this is, in a sense, part two of a dialogue. We'll be focusing on The Committed, and as we'll be thinking through the book, I cannot promise there won't be any spoilers. It's very hard to talk about a book in depth or as a critical object without mentioning the contents, I think. So if you don't like spoilers, please do hit pause on the video and go sit down immediately with the novel instead, and we'll be here later. But I think my first question for you is a bit of a silly one. How do you find spoilers, Viet?
Well, I hate spoilers. And the part of the problem is that I can never read or watch things fast enough to beat people or beat reviewers. I'm always months and months behind. And so I have to be very careful, not to read certain reviews. And it is useful if people warn in advance, we're going to give away the entire plot or at least a big surprise at the end.
I find that really funny, actually, because I feel like you play a lot with the spoiler in your own writing. The conceit of The Committed. Well, actually, no, it was a bit spoiled for me because you announced publicly that it would be a trilogy. But aside from this, it kind of reveals and then doesn't reveal itself in its first few pages. So in the prologue, he writes, we were certain of two things. The first was that we were absolutely going to die. And the second was that we would almost certainly live. and then it's followed in the next chapter almost immediately with a narrator comments, what a peculiar position, being dead. And I guess this is a two-part question. I'd love to know how these first lines kind of came into being. And then what made you decide to situate the reader like this?
I'm probably not giving anything away in terms of a spoiler by saying that our narrator has two holes in his head that have been put there by his best friend, because he tells us that on the very first page of chapter one. And so it's always interesting or fun for me as a reader and as a writer to do this kind of thing, and then for the reader to try to figure out, if he's got two holes in his head, how can you tell this story? And why did his best friend shoot him in the head? And so you have to read the entire book to find out exactly what took place. But in fact, those particular lines of chapter one didn't come to me until I think I was like at least two-thirds of the way through the novel, and I realized, oh, this is what's going to happen. Now I got to go back and insert the details from the very beginning. But the prologue, which precedes that, that was interesting for me to write because it's a prologue that is a little bit detached from what follows, because the prologue is set on the South China Sea with a boatload of refugees fleeing from Vietnam, including our narrator and his best friend. And chapter one picks up when they arrive in Paris at the Charles de Gaulle airport. So the prologue was important to me, though, because it had to set the tone for the entire novel. And I was thinking in mythic terms. I wanted to have an opening that would situate readers in a world of both realism in terms of what happened to Vietnamese refugees, but in a world of a mythic scale, because I think that refugees who take to the open seas are embarking on an odyssey. They're embarking on a heroic journey. Now, people who are not refugees, I think, don't think of this, because the way that refugees are represented in mass media, for example, is oftentimes in very abject terms as objects of pity and people who are desperate. But I think that that is a mistake of narration. That's a mistake of the imagination. And it's up to us who are refugees or who have been refugees or who are sympathetic with refugees to really change the terms of that narration to focus on the heroic dimensions of what refugees are doing. And so that's what the opening wanted to do. And so I had to find the appropriate language for that and also connect it stylistically to the sympathizer. So that was my thought process as I was writing that prologue.
It's so beautiful. I feel like you really dig into kind of the contradictory messaging of, you do this incredible comparison of like how the unwashed, helpless refugee versus the British who arrive on the Mayflower, which I like, it's consistent, it's incredible, this consistent kind of unpacking of contradictions. I'd love to actually dig into a little bit about the relation between the sympathizer and the committed, because there's this real tonal shift in the committed. Even though it's very static in Paris, it gets very fast. It's like quite a dramatic shift due to the events of the sympathizer. And I was just wondering when you decided that the sympathizer wasn't just going to be a standalone book, that it would be a trilogy.
When I finished the sympathizer, I realized I'm still invested in our narrator, the sympathizer, and I want to know what happens to him, because the end of his story in the sympathizer, the novel, is that he's a revolutionary who's been disabused of his revolutionary ideals. And I think for those of us in the capitalist democratic West, this is a very familiar narrative. You know, the communist who decides that communism is not everything that it's cracked up to be, and then runs off and joins the West. And I felt that that was not actually the ending of the sympathizer. I felt that he wasn't going to just run off and join and, you know, become a capitalist, become an American, and all that. And yet, at the same time, there aren't a lot of narratives that try to deal with what happens to revolutionaries after they've been disabused of their revolution. So that sets the stage for the committed. And I felt that, you know, there is something still important to say about that stage of someone's intellectual and political development. And then the challenge for me is, how do I do that in an entertaining way? Because hopefully the sympathizer was an entertaining novel as a spy novel, even as it tried to get across these critiques of colonialism and American warfare and Vietnamese communism. And that's the same challenge in the committed, to explore this revolutionary psychology and mentality, and then also to have some fun with a narrative about drugs and sex and violence and gangsterism in the City of Light.
It's so much fun. I was just chatting to my friend before about the passage where there's no punctuation. It's incredibly breathless and it for a few pages, and you realize it's because they're strangling someone. It's incredibly fun in form. But it's like there are many very grisly murder scenes. How did you approach these moments? Like, obviously they're very funny in a very dark sense, but how did you prepare for these very grisly moments in the book?
Well, people who haven't read The Sympathizer or The Committed are hearing you say, well, it was a lot of fun seeing someone strangled for six pages without punctuation. And so that might seem weird, but in fact, if you found it fun, then I did my job, because people sometimes ask me, well, you know, you write these torture scenes and violence and all these kinds of things that are difficult to do. Partly, yes, for obvious reasons, but as a writer, I'm really having a lot of fun, because my challenge is to try to make something grisly, as you said, entertaining. And I happen to be of a certain mentality where I enjoy, for example, watching movies with a lot of violence. And so you talk about how there are a lot of murders that take place in the book. Well, these are usually, I think, murders that gangsters are committing on other gangsters. And I've never heard anybody complain that there's too much violence in a Martin Scorsese movie about gangsters in the United States or John Woo movies about gangsters in Hong Kong. And those are the kinds of movies I grew up watching and enjoying and really admiring for their style, their pizzazz, and the way they make something really violent into a spectacle that most people want to watch. And so that was the challenge for me to try to find how to do that equivalently on the page. And if the reader is having fun going along on this roller coaster ride of gangster antics and everything like that, even as people are getting blown away in one way or another, then again, I've hopefully done my job.
You did a great job. I mean, you mentioned Scorsese, and I know there were incredibly clear cultural reference in The Sympathizer. And I was wondering, they clearly changed, but could you speak a bit more to, I guess, cultural reference that you were inspired by or wanted to kind of lampoon in The Committed?
The Committed is set in Paris of the early 1980s, and the reason why that takes place is because our narrator, the Sympathizer, is part French and part Vietnamese. And in The Sympathizer, his French heritage is dealt with, but mostly the critique in that novel is aimed at the Vietnamese and at the Americans. And in The Committed, I wanted to make sure that the French really got their due, because I think the French really got away with a lot of things in Southeast Asia. Now, they did get defeated. They did get their army defeated and get sent home. But culturally, narratively, the way that the world remembers French colonialism in Indochina is very poor, if the world remembers it at all. And when it does, it oftentimes tends to remember it in terms of the visual imagery that the French left behind. And so the French have left behind these black and white photographs of really romantic settings of the French Empire in Indochina. And unlike the Americans, you know, gave us a full Technicolor rendition of all the atrocities and all the bombings and all that other kind of stuff that they did during the war in Vietnam. So the Americans have held themselves up to their own, you know, visual judgment, and the world remembers what happened in Vietnam during the American period as a bad war. And the world tends to remember what the French did as a romantic period of colonization, embodied by Catherine Deneuve in Indochine, the movie, for example. And so my inspiration in writing The Committed stylistically was partly that whole legacy of romantic French colonialism, which I wanted to debunk, because I, like many other people, have been seduced by the French. I love to go to Paris. I love the whole idea of French culture. I did not want to be the American. And this happens every year. There's always an American who writes some book praising French culture, right? Like the Americans are just completely easily seduced by French culture. I did not want to write that book. So this is a book about gritty Paris, immigrant Paris, refugee Paris, in contrast with the world of left-wing elite intellectual Paris, because that's also who he interacts with as well. So I wanted to satirize those people and illuminate the world of refugees and immigrants. And really, it's easy to satirize French intellectuals and leftists. That was not a challenge. And I think finally, the last source of inspiration was probably French cinema. You know, if you watch French New Wave cinema or French noir dramas of gangsters in black and white during the era of the 1950s. I mean, I love that stuff. They're very fast-paced, very stylish, very violent, and very French. And so hopefully all those elements are going to be present in The Committed as well.
Very French. Did you spend much time in France while you were writing or to research the book?
Yes, the research, quote unquote, I did a couple of summers in France, in Paris, partly just to reabsorb the energy of the city, because I'd been there before. And the novel is set in the early 1980s. And one of the good things or easier things about writing about Paris is that the city geographically and architecturally hasn't changed too much in 40 years. The people have changed and the mores have changed and so on, but the setting hasn't changed so much. But I really also wanted to talk to the French of Vietnamese descent in Paris, because I had a feeling that they are quite different than Vietnamese Americans. Even the very terminology that I'm using, like in the United States, we can call ourselves Vietnamese Americans, but you don't really call people Vietnamese French or French Vietnamese, because the French don't believe in this kind of hybridization or dual identity type of things that the Americans like to believe in. And so talking to the French of Vietnamese descent really confirmed that many of them have a completely different worldview than the Vietnamese Americans. I mean, they've grown up under French notions of universalism and humanity that are somewhat different than the American version of multiculturalism and democracy. And I also wanted to make sure that I got my details right about the French life there, especially for Vietnamese immigrants and refugees and their descendants. So one of the details, for example, is that our narrator, the sympathizer, has to get a job when he's in Paris. He makes some very bad choices because he's deeply traumatized. So he starts to work for a crime boss who's called the boss. And I asked my French or Vietnamese informants, okay, this is going to be a Vietnamese gangster drama in Paris. And they said, there are no Vietnamese gangsters. We don't do that kind of thing. And I thought, that's interesting because I grew up in a Vietnamese refugee community in the United States, and we did that kind of thing a lot. So I solved the problem by making the narrator, by making the boss Chinese, Vietnamese of Chinese ancestry, and the French people of Vietnamese descent said, yes, the Chinese really would do that kind of thing. So that was the kind of details that I needed to get right with these so-called research trips to Paris.
I feel like you managed to encapsulate a lot of that real strangeness in the image of the banh mi. I'm not sure where it is in the book. I'd love you to read that part, but I have lost it. Also thinking through, I think you mentioned just before how Paris hadn't changed for you hadn't changed since the 80s. There's this moment where the protagonist sees the Notre Dame, and it's kind of like the opposite of the simulacra. Like he's seeing the final real thing when he's grown up with this fake Notre Dame. And I was wondering if you could kind of speak to this odd colonial authenticity.
Well, first of all, with the banh mi, I think it's like on page 2 of chapter 1, but is the banh mi popular in Australia as
well? Oh yeah, it's a huge deal.
Okay. So what I call it is, you know, that what basically happens with the banh mi is the French came and colonized us in Vietnam, did all kinds of terrible things to us, right? But they also did some good things, which is to give us some of their, you know, customs around food and drink and so on. So the baguette is something the French brought to Vietnam. And the Vietnamese, in my opinion, I don't know if we made the baguette better, but we have definitely made the sandwich better, because the Vietnamese banh mi is way better than any kind of sandwich you can get in France. Okay, I will bet money on this. And I call the baguette in the opening chapter the dialectical baguette, because it's a symbol for me of how history changes, even at the level of food. But of course, one of the things that we have to be really careful of here, and I think it's probably true in Australia as well as in the United States, is that when we're faced with these issues of cultural conflict and confusion and all these kinds of things, racism and all that, there's one tendency to say, well, if we all ate the same food, if we all appreciated each other's cuisines, we'd all get along better. So the banh mi is an earlier example of hybrid fusion cuisine. Now you have Korean bulgogi tacos, for example. I don't know what we have in Australia. But the banh mi already did this by combining the French and the Vietnamese, and no political problems were solved. No economic exploitation was resolved because of the dialectical baguette or banh mi. So enjoy the banh mi, enjoy your hybrid fusion. It's not going to solve your identity crises or the histories of colonialism and their after effects. And the idea of Notre Dame is related to that as well, because the French came to Saigon and they basically tried to build a version of Paris in Saigon by using a similar geometrical grid as was done in Haussmannia in Paris. And they built certain kinds of architectural monuments that echoed or, you know, were direct references to Parisian architecture. And there is at the very center of Saigon our version of Notre Dame, which doesn't look very much like the actual Notre Dame in Paris, but sort of, you know, it is a cathedral. And so when you are a colonized subject, I think you're always aware of this idea that you are almost white, but not quite. You're almost like the original colonizer, but you can never be that way. And so the idea of the replica, the imitation, which never quite lives up to the original, including the colonized person himself in relationship to the colonizer, I think is always present in colonized consciousness. And that's partly what The Committed deals with our narrator finally getting to go to the real Paris, seeing the real Notre Dame, and somewhere around that moment, I believe, stepping into a pile of dog excrement, right? And he thinks, we in Vietnam do not have this problem. We are more civilized than the French because we eat our dogs before they can poop on the street. So, I mean, so there's that, hopefully this comic critique that cuts both ways that runs throughout the committee. And apologies to all the dog lovers out there.
I think the comic critique is something which is just, it's incredible. It's so surprising because you're really hitting this, the heart of this, what is horrifying, but in an incredibly satirical way. I'm going to jump to this question. I myself am clearly mixed race. I'm a diasporic subject living in a colony who's studying literature. And your narrator really resonated with me on a surface level in his positionality as a mixed race diasporic subject living in a colony who majored in literature. But there's so much more. There's such a deeper recognition in these novels that kind of surpasses this portrayal of identity, in that, like, through these 700 pages of confession, you make really clear this unending, banal, crushing experience that is racism. And like I said, there are incredibly funny moments where you're illuminating the contradictions in racism and colonialism and imperialism. But it's just so clearly not something the narrator has gotten over or can ignore. He's like continually engaging with it. I'm sure you and I both do, it's relentless. I was just wondering if you could speak to this choice to make racism not just a theme or a theorized concept that's brushed over or just a pinpointed trauma, but almost like it's kind of like an effective texture to both novels?
I think that there are obviously individuals who can say, honestly, according to themselves, they've gotten over racism. You know, whatever choices they made in their lifestyle and whatever, they've got it pretty good. You know, they're not affected by racism any longer. Well, good for them. It's just because a particular individual may have been able to get over racism, and I don't even know what that means. Structurally, we have not. And structurally, we cannot, simply by doing things like eating hybrid fusion or marrying a person of a different background or anything like that. Maybe good for the individual, but structurally, we still live under conditions of racism and inequality as an outcome of colonization. I mean, the modern world is shaped by 5 centuries of colonization and its consequences. That would include Australia, as you already alluded to, with the land acknowledgement at the very beginning. This is a foundation of settler colonial societies like the United States and Australia. It is certainly a part of the fundamental history of a country like France and what it did in places like Haiti and Indochina and so on. And so our narrator is a living embodiment of that. That's a very deliberate choice of my part to make him a mixed race person. So he literally embodies what colonization did to humans and to their bodies and to the mixing of different kinds of cultures in lineages that are, you know, being transmitted through the whole mixing of populations. And so he himself is someone who can never get over not just racism, but colonialism, because I think it's colonialism that generates racism. Racism becomes a justification for what happens under the conquest, colonization, genocide, all these terrible things that were part of colonization. And so he can never get over these kinds of things because France, Vietnam, the United States have never gotten over them. We're still living in the history that colonization generated. So through his psychology, his way of seeing the world, his, as you put it, textured experience of history, he is going to be our reminder that colonization and racism have not gone away. And he's going to be the person who's going to be persistently critical of those very things that he himself cannot escape.
It's a real predicament, I think. There's such a sense of, I think, capaciousness in the committed. I feel like we've been with him long enough to realize that People will disappear only to reappear. He'll leave places only for them to resurface in his memory. And like obviously the major theme of race, but also class and ideology, they're kind of very much ever present and always in a process of this continued examination. And I was thinking about this through just the title of your last nonfiction book, Nothing Ever Dies. And these novels are just so haunted by personal history, but also capital H history. And I was wondering if you could speak to the form of The Committed, just in terms of it's constantly looping back and looping through in this almost like kind of tissued layered way.
There is a consistency, I hope, between the sympathizer and the committed in terms of style, at least in one sense, you know, with the rhythm of the language and the fact that you're living completely within the sympathizer's head and you're being carried along partly by the plot, but also simply by his voice, because he's constantly talking. The two books are confessions, but they're really also monologues where he's constantly talking to you. So you better like that voice if you're going to persist through, as you said, 700 pages of these two books. But The Committed is also a little bit different because the sympathizer is driven by a spy narrative, and it's a fairly cohesive plot. He has a mission that he has to achieve in The Sympathizer, and it's a mission that's very familiar with anybody who reads spy narratives. But in The Committed, he's no longer a spy. He no longer has a sense of mission. He's completely unmoored. He's been deeply traumatized by what happened to him in the first novel. And he's trying to both cope with the trauma and trying to figure out if it's possible to rebuild himself and how. But because the novel is written as a confession from his point of view, he cannot actually communicate his trauma to us. I mean, he can communicate the events that have taken place, but he's not in the situation to step back and say, I'm a victim of post-traumatic stress disorder. So my challenge as a novelist is, how do I convey this at the level of the story? I mean, how would someone who is deeply traumatized tell his story? And you gesture to that by saying, you know, the time, you know, the narrative of time goes back and forth, and, you know, he goes to the present, to the past. He's fixated on certain kinds of events that repeat. We're not even certain if some of the things that happened to him really did happen to him, or at least in the way that he describes them. So we're living through his psychology, his deeply damaged psychology, which is both tragic and also comic. And so the narrative style gestures at all of that by hopefully making us feel what it is that he's feeling rather than telling us what it is that he's feeling.
I feel like the fractured temporality speaks wildly to, I mean, trauma. And you said in an interview, I feel like the other day, your doctor friend diagnosed the committed, the narrator, mm-hmm. with PTSD, I think. I thought that was incredible. Can we please talk about the false bottom? It's such a funny phrase. I think I said the book is capacious. It's kind of endless. The horizon recedes because you're stuck in his mind. But there's, I think it's all concentrated in this object, which is his leather duffel bag with a false bottom used to hide his first confession. In the final scene of The Committed, the false bottom is ultimately plundered. And I'm intrigued by this image that he's carrying with him all the time, but also like in the sense that you manage to both use it as a theory of revolution almost and as a narrative structure. It's such an incredible tying together of all these things. I don't even know how to articulate it.
Well, good, because I can't really articulate it either. The false bottom just originally derived in The Sympathizer from just a trick of the spy craft. You know, he has to smuggle stuff. So how does he do it? He's going to do it through a duffel bag with the false bottom. And, initially, it just contained like a spy camera and some rolls of film in it, right? But it was very clear to me in The Sympathizer that one of the themes that the novel deals with is homosocial relationships, the relationships between men, which may or may not be homoerotic at bottom, right? And if you know what bottom means in gay discourse. So it's just intuitive at that point that I'm using this idea in The Sympathizer. And in The Committed, I expand on the false bottom very deliberately, because part of what The Committed deals with is not just homosocial relationships and the potential for homoeroticism and male competition and all of that, and what the bottom signifies in that kind of a relationship, but I'm also dealing with heteronormative masculinity. Because in The Sympathizer, what becomes really clear is that you cannot separate the violence of war, which is what the novel is explicitly concerned with the violence of sexuality, because I think these two things happen simultaneously, the erotic imagination, the masculine imagination, the militaristic warlike imagination, which governments, generals, men often want to deny. Everybody's okay with talking about militarized violence, but it's difficult to talk about sexual violence because you can't reconcile sexual violence with codes of honor and patriotism and all of that. But in fact, they all happen simultaneously, and the sexual violence is denied. So by the end of The Sympathizer, he's beginning to intuit this relationship between his heteronormative masculinity that he's so invested in, because he's so proud of being this sexually capable, seemingly attractive Asian male, with the horrible events that transpire at the end of the novel. So I wanted to pursue that in The Committed. I wanted him to fully confront what his heteronormative masculinity means. And so that would involve both interrogating his own sexuality, his relationships with women, but then also, again, this idea of how none, and all that can't be extricated from the homosocial. So the false bottom, I have no idea where I'm going with it, honestly. But part of what it means to have a false bottom is you never hit bottom. And so the two novels so far are about him thinking, I finally hit bottom. Things have gotten really bad at the end of The Sympathizer. He doesn't know they can get a lot worse. And so that's what happened in The Committed. In The Committed, it goes even deeper through that false bottom. So there's a third novel. I'll try to figure it out exactly what that means with the false bottom. Is there an actual bottom beneath the false bottom? And in the final scene of The Committed, all I'm going to say is it's impossible what gets pulled out of the false bottom. There's just way too many things that are coming out of the false bottom, because if it was capacious enough to handle all these things that are coming out, there's no way it would be false, because you could clearly see that it would be way too deep. So it's just partly it's just having fun too. It's like this magic duffel bag from which you can pull out anything from its false bottom. And to me, besides the sexual dimensions, there's also a psychological dimension to that too. Like, we, I think, have false bottoms in our own consciousness. I don't think any of us really know how deep we can go into our own psyche. Just when we think we know what we're about, maybe there's another layer beneath that false bottom.
No. I hadn't even clocked that. I think I was so enraptured in the actual scene, the last scene. I didn't realize it was this Mary Poppins-esque bag where he just keeps pulling. That's so funny. Incredible.
Then I did my job as a writer. You didn't think twice about the fact that, oh, first this thing, then this thing, then this thing is coming out of the false bottom.
Yeah, I was too taken. Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, maybe this means there's a fourth book in the series, or a fifth one. Well, you'll never be able to stop. Sorry. Okay. I think this almost leads us perfectly to my next question, where we have to speak about nothing, and the concept of nothing being this really long-running joke and an answer to a question posed both by Lennon and by you in The Sympathizer. It appears so frequently. I did a search of the soft copy, and it appears 111 times throughout the novel, which I found quite amusing, because nothing literally permeates the text. But the first appearance is quite a provocative one, as it appears in the epigraph. Would you actually mind reading it? Do you have a copy nearby?
I memorized it. So the epigraph comes from Ritti Pan's memoir, I guess would be the right term, The Elimination, which he co-wrote with Christophe Bataille, a novelist. And Ritti Pan, for those of you who don't know him, is probably Cambodia's premier artist and intellectual of the genocide, everything that happened during the Pol Pot regime with the Khmer Rouge and afterwards. And he did a brilliant film called The Missing Picture, about autobiographical film about barely surviving the genocide, done with hand-carved figurines instead of, you know, human actors. He's done a lot of movies, but that was the one that got him the Oscar nomination. And then The Elimination, that this memoir is his account of tracking down, at the time, the only Khmer Rouge official convicted of crimes for what happened during the Pol Pot regime. And the quotation is, "Nothing's more real than nothing." And I found The Elimination to be a really compelling work because what Ridipan does, of course, is to interrogate the Doik, the commandant of S-21, who was in charge of like killing 17,000, murdering and torturing 17,000 prisoners. But Ridipan doesn't give us an easy way out. He doesn't say, "Hey, Doik is a monster and, you know, we should condemn him." Instead, he says Doik is a human being. And the line of difference between us and Doik is really, really thin. And that Cambodia should be at the center of human history, not because of the victims, but because of what the Cambodians did to themselves as both the victims and the torturers and the killers. And that civilization reaches its apotheosis in Cambodia. So he does all these maneuvers that are the complete opposite of the standard kind of sentimental moralization expect by saying, look, the French were the ones who brought this theory of civilization to Cambodia. Cambodians just took it a lot further, but the roots of it were in French civilization. So the French need to be held accountable for what happened during the genocide as well. So I think Ridipan and I are sharing a lot of the same worldview and our desire to not let off the hook so easily when it comes to talking about the horrors of history. The horrors of history don't come from outside. The horrors of history come from inside, because the people who commit these acts, for the most part, just like you and I, you know, we can hold up sort of Pol Pot or Hitler as, you know, demons, but they had to have millions of people willing to go along and do these terrible things. That's the kind of horror that Ridipan really wants to confront, and what I want to try to confront as well. And the fact that Ridipan was willing to say nothing's more real than nothing resonated with me so much, because I think a lot of people, you know, have a unidimensional understanding of nothing. And the insistence of these two novels, The Sympathizer and The Committed, is always about the dialectical understanding of things, that things always have a duality of meaning at the very least. And so that's why in the two novels, there's a lot of wordplay, because I'm interested in how one word can mean more than one thing, especially in this example, nothing. So nothing, the common sense understanding is, well, there's nothing there. There's an absence. But in fact, nothing is a presence. And in certain kinds of religions like Buddhism, the nothing or the void is not to be dismissed, right? And so if you are coming at this with an understanding that nothing is a purely negative thing and negative things don't have any value and no meaning, then you don't understand half of what's happening in these two novels. So The Sympathizer is about nothing in the sense that there's a nothingness at the heart of the ideals that we hold so dear. And that's built on a joke that I'm not going to give away in the novel. But it's also built on a fact that The Sympathizer does nothing when he should have done something. I won't give away what happens there too. And it's the reverse in The Committed. In The Committed, he should do something. I'm confusing myself. He does, in The Sympathizer, he does nothing when he should do something. And in the Committed, I'm confusing myself. But anyway, there's a duality between nothing and something that gets reversed in these two books. You're confusing me with my own philosophy.
I think, I was so interested when he does choose to do nothing when he is asked to do something. Because it felt like just absolutely right. I was like, oh, this is why there's a third book. It was that moment where I was like, I see. I actually mentioned the epigraph because it's often attributed to a different person, to Samuel Beckett. And I was intrigued by you swerving away from that. But I thought it was perfectly resonant with the conversations which the narrator and the Maoist psychoanalyst have. And I was wondering if we could speak a little bit about this, it's not a binary you set up, but like this conversation you're setting up between lived experience and theory and the very hairy kind of gnarly relationship that they have.
Yeah, I think I wanted to have Riddhi Phan say these words in the context of the Cambodian genocide. So that it's actually rooted in a really terrifying history and not just something that can be displaced onto something, you know, that's purely about art. It's about both in Riddhi Phan's work, but you cannot get away from the relationship to the genocide and the nothingness that can be one result of that. So, you know, I'm of a background, you know, with a PhD in English, deeply influenced by French philosophy, French theory, French writers, and all of that kind of thing. And I'm very sympathetic to French intellectual projects, especially, you know, in the post-1968 moment. And yet, that doesn't mean that I think that those ideas and those practitioners are somehow immune from satire or from the contradictions of their own histories and their own locations. Anybody who spends any time reading about French intellectuals realizes there's plenty of contradictions and plenty of things to satirize. And if you spend time with them, you realize. So I thought it would be important to, you know, the sympathizer, it's a book that's very critical of right-wing ideas and conservatisms of various kinds. And I thought, I think the left is equally capable of doing stupid and terrible things in the name of their beliefs as the right is. And again, if you look at Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge, that was, you know, Marxism carried out to a horrifying extreme. And so it felt important to me to be able to satirize the French intellectual left in the committed, again, partly because it's a lot of fun, but then partly because the contradictions that French intellectual leftists find themselves in are not that different from what American intellectual leftists like myself find ourselves in as well. So even though I'm having fun sort of ruthlessly mocking the pretensions of French intellectuals from the liberals to the Maoists, I'm hopefully also, you know, gesturing at the general predicament that intellectuals who are invested in revolution find themselves in.
I feel like the sympathizer moves like through different sites, from Vietnam to America to the Philippines to America to Bangkok to Vietnam. But the committed instead makes a very specific choice to stay firmly planted in Paris. And a lot of the movement to me feels through theorists, like kind of almost like there's so much play there, but you've really chosen to take something which I think often in Australia and America is like sequestered in the institution of the university, and you've brought it down into gangster Paris. And obviously I have to quote, or I have to cite the bouncer at the brothel who was reading Fanon. It's phenomenal. And I was just wondering, like, how you came to decide to make this book. It's very, like, clearly a novel of ideas.
A novel of ideas in which there's a lot of sex, drugs, and violence taking place. Let me just point that out, you know, that, you know, we have a lot of murders, gangland hits, orgies, prostitutes, you know, with sex workers, all of this stuff is going on. Lots of consumption of various kinds of drugs are taking place in the book as well. I don't see the walls that need to be erected between the idea of a novel of ideas and all these other kinds of things. Because if you look at revolutions, for example, I mean, revolutions are often fomented not in the world only of the intellectuals, but in the world of the outcasts and the outsiders, the ones who were in prisons, the ones who are the sex workers, and so on, where revolutions are actually being, you know, talked about, being developed in practice, and all these kinds of things. And so that was why it was important for me, for example, to work against type. You know, the bodyguard or the bouncer in the brothel is a big black Senegalese muscle bound guy who's called the muscle. You know, but does that mean he can't read, you know, philosophy and theory? Why not? I mean, what kinds of assumptions are we making here? And then, you know, also, I think that ideas are thrilling, and this is a thriller. So thrillers, you know, are conventionally defined as, again, drugs, violence, crime, this kind of thing. But in fact, if ideas are thrilling, then you can have thrillers about ideas as well. And if we think about the ways in which history has shifted all over the world, it's oftentimes as the consequence of ideas. We're talking about communist revolutions. We're talking about revolutions that are inspired by really heavy duty philosophy. Try to read Marx's Capital, for example. It's 1,000 pages. It's really dense. Somehow Marx was able to inspire revolutionary movements all over the world. He wasn't the only one. So ideas can be thrilling. Ideas can be moving. Ideas can generate violence if they don't happen to be violent themselves. And so I'm of the background where I think that when you look at the ways that revolutions are actually generated, it's not the Hollywood version where some good-looking person who decides to single-handedly take on the system. It's oftentimes a bunch of people tossing around ideas and getting excited about them and getting motivated and then going out and organizing and getting to the streets or doing secret organizations and that kind of thing. So this is the terrain of the committed. And for me, the climax of this novel is not really the shooting and the violence that takes place. Although, again, there's a lot of that. The climax of the novel is really the culmination of ideas that takes place near the end of the book. The most fun part of the book for me was not the breathless 6-page strangulation sequence that you're talking about, but more of a 2 or 3 page sequence towards the end where our sympathizer, our narrator, really starts to put it all together. He starts to understand who he is and what he wants to do with his new revolutionary vision. And that was thrilling for me to write, to be able to say the things that he articulates towards the end in terms of being finally articulate about himself, his ideas, and his beliefs.
Do you feel like you could ever articulate this in a different form? This, like, his kind of... I know it's a silly question. We're talking about a novel. But, like, do you think the novel is the only container for these ideas for you right now?
No, I think you mentioned my book, Nothing Ever Dies, and that's really the theoretical companion so far to both the sympathizer and the committed, where I work through a lot of these ideas that we've been talking about in terms of war and humanity and, war and trauma and all these kinds of things. And I'm writing a memoir, which I never thought I would do. And in writing the memoir, I thought, I'm a really boring person. I have to speak more as if I am the sympathizer in this book than I am me. Because a sympathizer is a me or a part of me, and the much more interesting part of me that I generally don't tend to reveal, but is greatly amplified in these novels. And so there is a way in which hopefully it's looping back into the memoir to allow me to say some of these things. But ironically, what I've encountered so far in writing the memoir is that, again, the sympathizer really has a life of his own, and he really is able to say a lot of things that I believe, but I generally don't go around talking about. And it's a lot harder, actually, to say it in my own voice in the memoir, Seek Memory.
Yes, the reference to Nabokov. when is the memoir out, may I ask?
God knows. I'm desperately trying to finish a draft by the end of the month so I can turn it over to my editor and agent, and we'll see what they have to say.
I want to read the memoir. Actually, I have a few small questions. I'm like incredibly amused by the naming conventions in the book. Especially there's one in particular which I think is an incredibly Australian joke, which is Richard Head, the plagiarist. They're almost Dickensian, I think. It almost references to like the characters in Bleak House. I was wondering if you could just talk, or like if you had a favorite character name or how you kind of come to them, because they're very funny.
Well, yeah, I mean, Richard Head was a lot of fun. It's a very American joke too, not just very Australian joke. But I'm glad it resonates there. The bouncer that we mentioned, the muscle, I think that his full appellation is the eschatological muscle. Right. And again, it's part of the fun and coming up with these names is how do you make the names memorable for people? I mean, names themselves can be memorable, but nicknames are oftentimes much more memorable. And so, of course, again, we're talking about Scorsese and the Italian-American gangster drama. They always have colorful nicknames. I wanted to gesture at that. Memorable adjectives. So in the sympathizer, we have the crapulent major, which people seem to have a lot of affection for that particular name. I think with the nicknames for these characters, they're fun to devise. They're meant to make them memorable. They're oftentimes probably easier to remember than actual names. So a lot of these characters in real life would have Asian names, for example. And for the non-Asian, typical non-Asian person, they'd be running around thinking, I can't remember who that person is and what their names are. And a different kind of novel would take up that problem or that challenge of working with actual Asian names or other kinds of names. But these particular novels work on, again, on a different terrain where the style and the language are heightened in certain ways and doing things that are unexpected, such as not giving people standard names for the most part, becomes a way of making the style stand out as well as the characters.
So I really loved The Cowboy. It took me so long to realize what it was a reference to. And I think finally the last question really about the book for me is also about a name, about the protagonist. You give him your last name, which is amusing to me because you just said that you needed to write in his voice for your memoir, so it's kind of a similar gesture. But it's also a false name, and I was just wondering if you could speak a little to that.
Well, you know, we do find out that he has a passport because he has to get to France, so he has to get a passport. And there is a name in the passport. The name itself is a joke, you know, because the name is Vo Yang. So everybody's going around calling him Vo Yang, and they don't realize that in Vietnamese, Vo Yang literally means nameless or anonymous. And it's the name that is what is inscribed on the tombstones of soldiers, dead Northern communist soldiers whose identities are never recovered. So it's a joke he's playing on the French bureaucracy, but it's really a sick joke where he's the butt of the joke himself for having this particular name. And then at some point he is given another name in the media. I won't tell you what incident is for that, but it's also a wrong name that's been provided by someone else. And as I was thinking, well, what should that name be? I thought, well, finally, I get to use my own surname in this story. I thought it would be a bit much if I gave him my entire name. But if I remember right, since it's been a while, his first name there is Joseph. I don't know if you recall.
Sorry,
right?
I meant your last. Joseph, your son.
Yeah, I mean, Joseph is actually my name as well. It's my Catholic baptismal name. So in a sense, I'm in there with him without the reader fully, most readers fully realizing that.
That's great. I love that. A real auto-fictive gesture, but a very funny one. I guess we're almost running out of time. This has been great. I have one question, last question for you. There are incredible moments of metacriticism, and I guess the book is metafictional as far as you want to label anything, really. But there are these moments where the characters read the confessions, which means they're also reading the sympathizer and the committed. So the lawyer, there's a lawyer character who reads for evidence. There's an aunt who's an editor who reads for style and story and character and theme. And there's a psychoanalyst who pours over anal and erotic fixations, which is incredible. And I guess my final question is, knowing full and well, courtesy of Bart, that the author is dead, but also right here with us, what's one thing you would like the reader to take away from The Committed?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, I do actually believe the author is dead. You know, at some point, hopefully not too soon, hopefully in 40 or 50 years, I will be dead. You know, so these conditions will be realized literally for me. And so I think in some ways the author's opinion is really unimportant, which is ironic because I give so many of these author interviews where I'm talking constantly about the books. And I think the reason why I do that is because I think that it's a privilege to be a writer who writes their books and then sits back and lets people interpret them, you know, because I think that there is a certain assumption of a common background there for a lot of writers who do that. You know, they, of course, not all readers will understand what they're doing. There's going to be interpretation, but they can assume, a lot of them, that they come from the same universe as their readers and their critics. And I feel like I could never make that assumption. You know, my work is in translation in different places or even in the United States. I'm a person of color. I'm an Asian American, Vietnamese American refugee, writing on topics that most Americans have a really hard time trying to confront, which is their, you know, the Vietnam War, settler colonization, racism. The Americans have so many hangups about these kinds of topics. And so I feel like I have to explain the thinking behind these books. And so in a sense, in this interview, I've already explained quite a bit about the thinking behind these books. So I think what I would hope for the reader is that the reader, and we're generalizing here, is provoked into thinking more about some of the issues that the books raise, because the books are novels, they're fictions, but they're, again, they're deep critiques as well as entertainments about racism and colonization and warfare, things that are not actually in the past, and things that I did not make up. And so hopefully the reader sees themselves in these books, sees themselves implicated in some way in these works.
That's a thank you so much, Viet, for a very thorough and wonderful conversation. And yeah, I guess that's it. a big thank you to the festival for having us and to all of you watching. If you'd like to buy this book, it's a good book, or any of the books by the festival's writers, there is an online bookshop on the festival website in partnership with Readings. So buy books to your heart's content. Thank you so much, and thank you, Viet.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.